Our next lecturer is Abel Pausch. He's originally from Texas. He was raised in Uruguay, where his father was a military attaché. He has a bachelor's and master's degree from the University of Texas, Austin, with a double major in English and a law degree from St. Mary's Law School in San Antonio. He is a decorated combat infantry platoon leader and company commander with the 4th Infantry Division in Vietnam, and he later taught at West Point. He's the author of a number of articles. He's writing a book right now, or The Secret Ledger of an Early Texas Doctor. Is that correct? Already published?
Okay. That one's out there, another one on Texas Germans and during the war.
Okay. Yeah, and he's currently writing a book about Texas Germans during the war. He's been an attorney in San Antonio for 30 years, where he is also adjunct professor of constitutional and contract law. He's a member of the Surgeon Church Council, St. Anthony's Orthodox Church. He is married to a fellow Texan, Phyllis, and has a daughter, Mary Lawrence. So I'd like to introduce Professor Pausch.
Thank you. Jeff, is this coming across here?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can move that wherever you want.
Jeff's talk is one heck of a hard act to follow. I'm afraid this one sounds a little dry in comparison. My wife out there, she came in a while ago, but I guess she left again. Oh, well. Somebody will be for me, I guess. The title of mine is Lincoln's Legacy. Who needs a Constitution? In order to discuss Abraham Lincoln's legacy to a country allegedly ruled by a constitution, it'll be necessary to touch on his war and the next decade, Reconstruction. From those years come almost all of the misplaced power we're suffering under today. Since power was and is the problem, and Washington's only legitimate power comes from the Constitution, that document and its history and its final corruption will be my focus. Just as humans need skeletons, political bodies need constitutions, whether written, established by custom, or even dictated by some ancient, real or mythical founding hero. Am I talking too loud? I'm deafening myself. Is it too loud? Okay. No. Okay. Well, I'll have to leave it to you to let me know, because I can't tell from up here. Seems to fade in and out, too. If that Constitution is bad, so will be the resulting social and governmental systems. But even if the Constitution is good, perfectly suited to the realities of human nature and the nature of governments, that Constitution can be overthrown, undermined, or neglected until the intended benefits of civilization and freedom are lost. In America, the states established a written constitution of the central government in 1789. Which worked well for over 70 years. After that, it did not fail. It was overthrown. Now the Constitution is in no way an obstacle to tyranny and decadence. Some might expect me to waste time on the subject of black slavery, but I will not. It was on the way out, burned out for the interruption of an unrelated war. Anyone who claimed that slavery was a cause of Lincoln's war would have been called a liar by Abraham Lincoln himself. It was the war and Reconstruction and their unconstitutional effects which led to the racial strife of today. After all, most countries of this hemisphere had black slavery, but none but America went through Reconstruction. My only interest and focus is on constitutional government. Since we're in Texas, I should remind those who are not from our state that the Texas Revolution of 1836 strictly concerned only constitutional matters. The Mexican Constitution of 1824. General Santa Anna had staged a coup in Mexico City and declared that constitution null and void. All of Mexico rose in revolt. Texas held out and continued to hold out. All the other states suffered terrible slaughters under Santa Anna. Finally, Texas seceded and wrote its own constitution. So it was a constitutional war, as was the war between the states. I find it fascinating that all political ills in America today can be traced back, thread by thread, to Abraham Lincoln, to Reconstruction, and their destruction of the U.S. Constitution. But first, I must overcome an error common not only in textbooks, but in the entertainment media, and even in most people's minds, Southern as well as Northern. The film scholars among you might remember D.W. Griffith's 1915 movie masterpiece, The Birth of a Nation. While glorifying the South and the Ku Klux Klan, it continually referred to Abraham Lincoln not by his name, but as, quote, great heart. It never mentioned the name Lincoln or the name Abraham in any way, and yet half the scenes take place with him in it. He was always great heart. Even Shirley Temple, in the movie The Littlest Rebel, turns to great heart Abe to win justice for her Southern family. These are supposedly pro-Southern films. The myth is that Lincoln would have been magnanimous toward the defeated South, and by extension, states' rights in the Constitution, but that after his assassination, the evil radical Republicans overthrew his benevolent plans and instituted the reign of terror and corruption known as Reconstruction. This myth has no basis in fact. There are three popular sources for the myth. The first is in Lincoln's inauguration after re-election in 1864, in which he said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all." I think most Southerners would have preferred a little less of his kind of charity. The second source was the several Confederate leaders who stated at the time that Lincoln's assassination would prove a, quote, calamity for the South. Even Claude Bowers, the greatest historian of Reconstruction, in his 1929 masterpiece, The Tragic Era, interpreted these comments as meaning that the Southerners somehow knew of Lincoln's benevolence and feared the radicals would take over after he died. In context, though, it's clear that what they meant was not that they'd be punished more harshly because of who took over, but because they'd be punished more harshly because of the blame for the assassination. Not that Lincoln and Congress had different plans for Reconstruction after the war. Bowers' more substantial argument is the Wade Davis Bill and the manifesto which followed it, in which Congress and Lincoln disagreed on when Reconstruction congressmen from the South would be seated in Congress. Actually, Lincoln agreed that Congress should decide the issue later on. Lincoln was a radical Republican, just as radical as the people in Congress who succeeded him. Also, President Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, was often forced to defend his more moderate policies by saying Abraham Lincoln would have wanted them. I think we can forgive Johnson that little lie. Lincoln would not have wanted them. But that's about it as for the basis for a magnanimous Lincoln after the war. The central government later became desperate to reunite the country by pretending that Abraham Lincoln was a hero to both the North and the South. This last desperation continues today. Actually, I'm not alone in my view of Lincoln and Congress's plans for the Reconstruction and for the Constitution. The longtime standard textbook, Reconstruction and the Constitution, was written in 1902 by John W. Burgess, PhD, LLD, Professor of Political Science and Constitutional Law, and Dean of Columbia University. He makes it clear that the Reconstruction plans of Abraham Lincoln and the radicals in Congress differed only in that Lincoln preferred absolute presidential rule, while Congress preferred absolute congressional rule. Neither had any regard for the restraints on the central government, ever. Burgess approves of this, written in 1902. Throughout his book, Burgess puts the word states in quotation marks. That's through 600 pages, states is in quotation marks. In his opinion, there had never been any states. There never were any states. Just temporarily convenient subdivisions of the central power, rather like post offices. You move them around as it's convenient. But his book went out of style finally, when people realized that American imperialism was his plan for the entire world. I have no idea why he put the word Constitution in his title. He never refers to it. To avoid confusion, let us recall that, quote, Republicans of Lincoln's time were on what we call the political left, and Democrats were on the right. What I mean will become apparent. In modern years, the two parties have largely reversed their positions and their ideologies. But party names don't matter. Constitutional principles do. Lincoln and his war began the destruction of the constitutional government. Of course, there had been various attacks on the Constitution from its ratification. All three branches of the central government tended to seize illegal power at one time or another, even before 1860. But the people in the states still studied and revered the Constitution. Every office holder swore to protect and defend it from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Those of you who served in the military or as attorneys have taken that oath at least once, if not twice or three times, to defend it against its enemies, foreign and domestic. Of course, the only enemies you can have that are domestic all are in Washington, D.C. It's that government in Washington, which is what the Constitution was written to restrain. Granted, it wasn't Washington at the time, but the central government was what the Constitution was written to restrain. That was America's opinion up until Lincoln nullified the entire Constitution. Every school child knows that Lincoln unconstitutionally suspended writ of habeas corpus, jailing for the duration thousands of writers, editors, publishers, speakers, and entire legislatures. He did that to Maryland without charges for 4 years. Actually, this breach might be the least of his violations. It's the only one we're told about in school, but it's probably the least important. Of course, Lincoln's bloodiest usurpation was going to war against 13 constitutionally sovereign states because they chose to exercise their option of leaving the Union, just as they had earlier chosen the option of joining the Union. I say 13 states. Some of you all are looking as though there were only 11 states. No, there were 13. Missouri seceded quite properly, exactly the same way South Carolina did, and so did Kentucky. That's why there's 13 stars on our flag and not just 11. Lincoln didn't believe any state seceded, so I don't know who came up with the number 11. Okay. Their option, the state's options in both their decisions, was recognized by every constitutional scholar of its time, including President Buchanan, Lincoln's predecessor. Even the small band of radical abolitionists who hated the South knew that any action against these states or their institutions would be unconstitutional. Hence William Lloyd Garrison, their leader, his famous description of the U.S. Constitution was a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. Later, William Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State, wrote, quote, "A written constitution is dangerous to us in the North," end quote. In order to pack the Senate, Lincoln even staged a coup in Western Virginia and unconstitutionally created a whole new state to give him two more votes. Our school children are not taught that Abraham Lincoln staged a revolution against the entire U.S. Constitution in defiance of his oath of office. Since Lincoln's specific victims were the states, and those most endangered were at war at the time, Lincoln faced little opposition to his power in Washington, D.C. Granted, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against him every time it got the chance, most famously in the prize cases of 1862, where it declared his war and all confiscations caused by it to be totally unconstitutional. Therefore, of course, Lincoln ignored the court and threatened to arrest and imprison it. The court suddenly became very quiet for the rest of the war. None of the northern states effectively resisted Lincoln's revolution. That submission by the northern states might be the most shameful aspect of Lincoln's revolution. It was up to them, as well as the southern states, to resist centralized tyranny. At the end of the war, the radicals in Congress had great hopes for the new U.S. President, Andrew Johnson. Johnson was of the mountains of East Tennessee. He had always hated the, quote, aristocrats, the planters, the rich slave owners of the South. So therefore, thought Congress, he must be a radical. He must agree with their plans. Actually, what most had forgotten was that Johnson was and remained a Southern Democrat, serving as such in Congress and as governor of Tennessee, and thus chosen for vice president by the new Union Party, invented to assure Lincoln's re-election in 1864. Most large slave owners were not Democrats, but were Whigs, as incidentally Lincoln had been. Johnson had always been an avid follower of Thomas Jefferson's philosophy. He had announced before the war that, quote, "Your states are sinking into mere petty corporations, mere satellites of an inferior character, revolving around the great central power here in Washington. Here is where your danger is. The time must come," he said in 1859, "when you must either preserve the Constitution or you must destroy the Union." Johnson had voted against Lincoln in 1860 and had campaigned throughout Tennessee against Abraham Lincoln. But this had been forgotten, and he ended up vice president and succeeded Lincoln upon Lincoln's death. After the war, the new President Johnson appointed an acting governor for each Southern state to prepare for the restoration of its full rights. Soon Johnson had a speech published that stated, quote, "There is no power to punish rebels collectively by reducing a state to a territorial condition," and that he was opposed, quote, "to the centralization of power anytime, anywhere." The speech was booed, and Congress's honeymoon with the new executive was over. The first issue of Reconstruction concerned giving the vote to black slaves. Because Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation had freed no slaves, it had not been intended to, and voting was a province of the several states, this could not be accomplished nationally under the Constitution. But black votes were necessary elements of Washington's manipulation of power. The hope was that they might cause a social revolution in the South, or perhaps even a race war there. And that's what Congress wanted. Strangely, suffrage was first urged by Indiana congressmen whose own states, the state of Indiana, refused blacks the right to school, the right to vote, the right to hold a job, or even the right to testify in court, even in their own defense. Later, the New York Tribune published the doggerel, "To every southern river shall Negro suffrage come, but not to fair New England, for that's too close to home." Union General and Republican Congressman John A. Logan defended President Johnson. Quote, "I disagree with those who think that these states are but territories. We fought upon the theory that a state cannot secede." He added that if Johnson expanded the suffrage to blacks, quote, "he does it in the teeth of the Constitution," end quote. "The states alone have the power," quote, "and until they make such a decision in their sovereign capacities as states, no president has a right to decide for them." Does this sound quaint in light of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the national lowering of the voting age, the controversy over voter IDs by the states, or the current regime and its party urging massive immigration to expand the role of voters? Jefferson Davis could not be tried, of course, because the U.S. Supreme Court would have reversed any conviction and also declared Southern secession to have been fully constitutional, nullifying all of Lincoln's war ends and endangering the power of the radical Congress. Thaddeus Stevens had assumed the leadership of the congressional radicals. He announced that, quote, "under the Constitution, no reform can be effected in the southern states, but by treating them as an outside, conquered people, they can be refused admission to the Union unless they voluntarily do whatever we demand." In the South, the slaves were free and being used to demand wages that employers no longer had. Northern soldiers were urged the blacks to leave their homes, leave their farms, leave their plantations, and gather in the towns where they could be addressed in large groups. Left alone, according to Bowers, the former masters and slaves might have effected a social readjustment to their mutual benefit, as they had in every other country that had had black slavery in the Western Hemisphere. But this was not the game intended by Washington. Very soon, the freedmen were eschewing labor and flocking to army camps to be fed, where they were promised that all the land would be given to them. Thaddeus Stevens in Congress had promised this. Had not their new friends from the North and the government been at pains to tell them that white Southerners were their enemies? Freedom meant throwing aside all marital obligations, deserting wives, and indulging in sexual promiscuity that soon took its toll in venereal diseases and abandoned children all over the South. Young colored women making their way to Northern camps, army camps, for freedom were used for immoral purposes by the soldiers. As Claude Bowers put it, Thaddeus Stevens was to become the most dictatorial leader, with one exception, in American history, and imposed his revolutionary theories on the country and on the Constitution. The bitter old man was born 2 years after the Constitution was ratified, in 1791, and he never reconciled himself to its principles. Constantly shifting his passions to any cause he thought might undermine it, he began as a passionate hater of private property and the rich, but soon gave support to Hamiltonian aristocracy, hoping to empower the central government. Stevens became obsessed with the thought that Freemasons were standing in the way of government, and helped form the Anti-Mason Party, advocating the disenfranchisement and imprisonment of all Masons. Then he merged his Anti-Mason Party with the Whigs and developed a passionate hatred of Andrew Jackson. Stevens then campaigned for protectionism, for ever higher tariffs to enrich the federal government, and I keep calling it the federal government, it's not the federal government, it's the central government, ceased being the federal government in 1861. The central government, and incidentally, advanced Stevens's own iron and corporate interests. He was in his 60s before he ever became an abolitionist. Then his wildest dreams came true. A long, bloody war was fought to destroy constitutional protections, attack states' rights, enhance centralization, support corporate subsidies and high tariffs, and destroy what he considered the Southern aristocracy and, as icing on the cake, perhaps even endanger slavery. But it would take his hardest work to eliminate all traces of the Constitution while Andrew Johnson was president. "The laws of war, not the Constitution," Stevens shouted in Congress. "Who pleads the Constitution? It is the advocates of the rebels." Stevens had no higher law to restrain him, because he subscribed to no creed, joined no church. His hometown newspaper even stated that Stevens has been all of his life a scoffer at religion and a reviler of all things sacred. In 1866, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton of Johnson's cabinet decided that the president should be deprived by law of his constitutional power as commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Congress promptly assumed that power to itself. Congress then passed an extension of the Freedmen's Bureau indefinitely, allotted 40 acres of southern land to be confiscated for each black family, armed the Bureau with absolute judicial powers to be exercised at will, and sent an army of petty officials to scour the country. Johnson vetoed the bill, saying it was, quote, "a governmental monstrosity. I cannot reconcile a system of military jurisdiction of this kind with the Constitution." At this point, the radicals used the congressional power to exclude its own members and purge Congress of all non-radicals, allowing it easily to override any presidential vetoes. Congress then passed what was later to be the 14th Amendment as a bill and ordered the Army to enforce it. They denied that a constitutional amendment was necessary because they denied that states had any power to ratify or approve or disapprove anything. The New York World stated, quote, "Had not the war shot that to death forever?" Freedmen were now enfranchised without an amendment, and almost all Southern whites and pre-war free blacks were disenfranchised. 1868 being an election year, and Henry Ward Beecher screaming "Copperhead" at all non-radicals, Ben Butler, Silver Spoons Butler, screaming "Rebel Hounds," Sumner screaming "Defenders of Massacre," all radicals shouting that Democrats and non-radical Republicans murdered former Union soldiers and that Johnson had plotted Lincoln's death, and that the southern states having had no vote at that time, the result was inevitable. Only radicals were elected, and the South knew now that utter ruin and abject degradation are its portion. That's a quote. In England, the London Telegraph reported that the United States, quote, "may remain a republic in name, but the people are subjects, not citizens." Then came the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Milligan case, which denied the right of Congress to suspend trial by jury, one of Congress's fancy little additions. The radicals promptly called for attacking the court by expanding the number of justices. Some of y'all are old enough to remember that having happened since then. But they chose simply to remove all the court's powers whatsoever. Stevens now demanded that the South be divided into military districts under commanders armed with absolute and arbitrary power. Quote, "Every government is a despotism. Better ours." His would, quote, "assure the ascendancy of our party forever," end quote. At least Stevens made no hypocritical excuses. Stevens then passed the Tenure of Office Act, which would become important, which prohibited the president from removing any of his appointees without the Senate's approval. Of course, Andrew Johnson vetoed it, but he was overridden. Then came the bill of impeachment of President Johnson, charging him with every imaginable crime. The charge was included that Johnson had actually instigated the assassination of Lincoln and conspired with John Wilkes Booth before the act. The London Times concluded that, quote, "it is the Constitution rather than Mr. Johnson who is in danger." Congress then passed the Military Act. Johnson vetoed it, and Congress overrode the veto and enforced it. General Sheridan was put in overall command. He ruled the South with an iron fist, and there was no right to appeal him. No court system, nobody. Not the president, not the Congress could overrule General Sheridan. He's the one who I'm sure a lot of y'all have heard in movies and things said, "the only good Indian is a dead Indian." The actual quote was, "the only good Southerner is a dead Southerner." He later amended it when he came to Texas. When someone complained about General Sheridan, Stevens replied, quote, "did not great empires come from the extinction of petty little states?" Still on the agenda was the impeachment of President Johnson. Johnson had fired his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, in violation of Congress's Tenure of Office Act. He had planned for General Grant to take over as Secretary of War, but Grant joined the radicals and snuck Stanton back into his office, sneaked Stanton back into his office, and that infuriated Johnson, but it guaranteed that Grant would be a radical from then on. Uh, The impeachment went on, but President Johnson was acquitted because of one radical who somehow felt himself bound by his oath to the Constitution and voted against impeachment. He was thrown out of Congress and died a ruined man until resurrected by John F. Kennedy in his book, Profiles in Courage. Now came the federally supported Union League clubs with thousands of agents meeting with large gatherings of former slaves. As Bowers put it, it was imperative to the Northern radicals that the black should be taught to hate, and teachers of hate were plentiful. In Georgia, Senator Benjamin H. Hill addressed the Reconstruction legislature. It was all attended by Union officers, radical leaders, the Freedmen Bureau, all the various elements of Reconstruction. Hill had gladly taken the oath of loyalty to the Union after the war, and the radicals thought he was one of them until they heard his speech. He lashed out at the radicals for the, quote, unholy work, end quote, of Reconstruction. Quote, go on confiscating, arrest without warrant or probable cause, destroy habeas corpus, deny trial by jury, abrogate state governments, on with your work of you ruin, ye hell-born rioters and sacred things. To the freedmen, he said, they tell you there that they are your friends, they lie. They tell you they set you free. They lie. They came down here to seek to use you to further their own base purposes. Improve yourselves. Learn to read and write. Build your homes. Live at peace with your neighbors. Drive off as you would a serpent these miserable, dirty adventurers who come among you and seek to foment among you hatred of the white race and of all things decent. Then Senator Hill wrote a denunciation of Reconstruction, which was published throughout the civilized world, all over Europe, translated into every language in Europe. Quote, the military bill leads to the complete change of American government from the principle of consent to the rule of force and to a war of races. All the guarantees of liberty, rung through the centuries, Magna Carta and elsewhere, all these things we've taken from the hands of despotism are now abrogated and withdrawn from 10 million people of all colors, sexes, and classes who live in unheard states. A conquered people are subject to the terms of the conquest, but only to those made known and demanded before or at the time of conquest. But every demand in the military bill originated after the war. Not one of them was demanded during the war or made a condition of surrender. They are rushing all sections and all races into wild, chaotic anarchy, end quote. That freed, by the way, Georgia from Reconstruction, that one speech by Senator Hill. The radicals were aghast. Everyone was discussing his speech in the boulevards of Paris and in the streets of London. Georgia was lost. The presidential race that year was between General Grant, Republican, and New York Governor Seymour for the Democrats. After the most corrupt campaign in American history, Grant won all but four northern states, and of course he lost Georgia. The radicals now had their president, but they were losing the hearts and minds of the American people. Under President Grant, the country's fortunes and industries were run on governmental monopolies, corruption, and bribes. Wall Street was considering moving to Washington, where all the power and the money was. Sort of an early version of the recurrent stimulus bills and bailouts. Grant's only escape from universal denunciation was to adopt radical reconstruction for 8 years, which he did. The next step was to appoint a young former slave to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He was wined and dined by politicians at the academy, after which it was found that he was totally illiterate, and he was thrown out humiliatingly and ridden out of West Point and sent back to his farm in the South. Even the radical newspapers said it was, quote, a very foolish and very cruel thing to do. But it was, after all, the beginning of affirmative action. The Dominican Republic was for sale by its dictator, and President Grant offered to pay $1.5 million for it. He also wanted Haiti, but Haiti had let it go, so long as he could get the Dominican Republic, at that time called Santo Domingo. He figured that since the country was all black, in his opinion, that would increase radical votes. Additionally, the Republicans figured that the Dominicans would be so grateful to be U.S. citizens under his party that they would vote Republican forever. Sound familiar? But the plan later fizzled because of the suspicion that there wasn't much money to be taken from the Dominican Republic. So what was it worth? Now, the Ku Klux Klan had been formed to protect Southern widows and orphans, but it degenerated into a lawless organization and was soon abolished by Southerners. Nevertheless, its activities were wildly exaggerated by radicals for years, for many years after it was abolished, to justify martial law throughout the South. After Stevens's death, the radical Senator Sumner ruled Congress. You recall him and his brush in with Representative Brooks before the war. He was famous for having, quote, absolute disregard of all constitutional restraints. The thieving became so blatant that many influential newspapers began laughing at politicians, and this was intolerable to the radicals. Something had to be done, so in 1871 they renewed the oppression of the South, of course. They passed laws turning over to federal court those accused of assault, robbery, murder. They institutionalized the packing of juries, abolished all state courts, authorized the president to declare martial law anywhere at will, and suspended again the writ of habeas corpus, all passed under the law entitled the Ku Klux Act. One congressman from the North, D.W. Voorhees, managed to oppose all this in a widely published speech to the chamber. You tender General Grant his sword and tell him to wield it against his countrymen in any direction he chooses, to strike whenever his passions, his hates, his ambitions, or his interests dictate, and upon such cause or provocation as to him alone may appear sufficient. Do you wish to establish lawless tyranny in this land? Here is its charter. But all that had already been established before Appomattox, and the Washington government was not impressed. As Bowers writes, came then the reign of terror, with wholesale arrests, businesses suspended, every citizen at mercy. Trials were mockeries of justice, the juries were packed with partisans when they even had juries. Today, all of our high school histories mention General Grant's corruption, or that corruption which took place under him. They never mention his tyranny throughout his period of presidency. Radical Governor John Patterson of South Carolina complained to Congress that Reconstruction could not be eased. There are 5 years more of good stealing in South Carolina, end quote. The Negro Militia, that was their official name, I don't use that term myself, were always drilling with fixed bayonets, forcing citizens from the streets. This is in South Carolina. They had 7,000 new Winchesters delivered to them every month, while law-abiding whites in the South were disarmed. The governor also imported a gang of gunmen from New York whose orders were, quote, to defend the governor and kill all of his enemies, end quote. That's their statement. Yes, sir. Oh, 5 minutes. Okay. When all this didn't satisfy him, he called on General Grant again for federal troops and was given them. Okay, the West also suffered, of course, with tariffs and railroad rates up. It was horrible in the West. All laws passed nowadays were called civil rights laws. I think I've heard that term before. There was a crash on Wall Street, a depression, and unemployment. In Louisiana, Grant reversed free election when the radicals lost. In St. Landry Parish alone, 821 farms and plantations were confiscated. The climax was, of course, when General Longstreet ended up being ordered to fire on his own troops that he had led in New Orleans. Sheridan declared all Louisianans banditti, outlaws, so that he could declare total war on all of Louisiana. Even the Nation magazine, radical then as it is today, called that demand the most outrageous subversion of parliamentary government by military force ever attempted in this country. I'll skip ahead to the election of 1876. Is a presidential year, and Hayes was a Republican candidate and Tilden was a Democrat. The overwhelming vote was for Tilden and against Hayes, and only the fact that Reconstruction manipulated the electoral votes of Florida and Louisiana was Hayes able to win by one vote. But an agreement for the silence of the South, Hayes agreed to lift Reconstruction. Now, I was going to go into the redemption of South Carolina, which was caused by former Confederate General Wade Hampton III. Read a biography about him. It's truly heroic, what he did before the war, what he did during the war, and how he saved South Carolina with his red shirts after the war. When South Carolina fell, Reconstruction fell. And Congress was therefore free to do whatever it wanted to, and the South had no vote anyway, but at least Southerners had their own state constitutions. Okay. It went on with the Republican Party dividing the spoils for the next 50 years, and corruption, and corporate greed and the corporate state continued to rule the country. Finally, the Republicans split between the progressive wing under Teddy Roosevelt, the progressive party at that time called the Bold Moves Party, and the Taft supporters, which resulted in the election of Woodrow Wilson, progressive Democrat. I wonder if the Republicans are going to pull that same trick of co-option this time. I can only touch on the low points of the 20th century, and I don't really have time to go into many of them. We ended up with an income tax and direct election of senators, further exercising the ghost of states' rights, and also unconstitutional Federal Reserve Bank, answerable to no one, and part of the cause of the Great Depression. Franklin D. Roosevelt forced through so many unconstitutional power grabs that he had to try to pack the Supreme Court again to get most of them to stick, shades of Reconstruction. By the 1960s, the Supreme Court was reawakening and wanted more of Washington's power. So the court now assumed the right to interpret the Constitution for the whole country, not just apply it to the parties as they were supposed to do. thus putting the Supreme Court above the Constitution, a perversion most recently decried by Justice Scalia. The court set out to abolish any remaining self-rule by applying the Bill of Rights, which was designed by Madison and the states to restrain the central government, and turning it on its head to restrain the states and localities instead, in addition to destroying any rules of democracy or mores left in America. Legal reasoning, common sense, and the dictionary were all discarded by the Supreme Court. In Congress, the Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965, both of them opposed by Senator Goldwater on the grounds that the 64 one abolished property rights, while the 65 one abolished states' rights in reference to voting. If you're curious, there's Article 1 and the Fifth Amendment was destroyed by the 1964 Act and the 65 Act destroyed Article 1 and or violated Article 1 and the 10th Amendment. In Texas, it calls us to have absolutely no say in the nomination of either party because our voting rights were suspended until the federal courts ruled on them. The last few decades have brought the deluge. Everything from wage and price controls, mountains of legislation by executive agencies instead of Congress, ever higher taxes, the Waco massacre, national minimum wages, corruption of the school system, oppression of small business, manipulation of the money supply, more irrational court decisions, including nationalized abortions and declaring state constitutions unconstitutional, national endowments for the degradation of the arts, massive land thefts by the EPA, oh, there's hundreds of them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all increasing the centralized power of Washington. The shades of Lincoln, Stevens, and Sumner are reveling wherever they are. Perhaps with an indulgent and disgusted smile at national sponsorship of sodomy, snail darters, and abortionists. Now comes our current president, Lincoln's disciple, and his decision to do without Congress when it bothers him, and thank the Lord I'm out of time.
No, you did fine. That was not a problem at all. Thank you so much.